The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're learning about some of the most fortunate accidents and fascinating personalities in the history of science. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. A little later, we'll talk to historian W. Bernard Carlson about his book, Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. But first, I'm joined by Dr. Mario Livio, an internationally known astrophysicist at the Space Telescope Science Institute, the institute which conducts the scientific program of the Hubble Space Telescope and will also conduct the scientific program of the upcoming James Webb Space Telescope. He's also the author of 5 popular science books, including The Golden Ratio and Is God a Mathematician? He's here to talk about his new book, Brilliant Blunders, From Darwin to Einstein, Colossal Mistakes by Great Scientists That Changed Our Understanding of Life and the Universe. Good to have you here, sir.
My pleasure.
So first off, just give us an overview of the book.
When people were asking me, what book are you writing? I used to say, it's about mistakes and it's not an autobiography. The idea was, there were a few ideas here. One was to show that even the greatest luminaries, and I've really chosen 5 giant scientists, also make mistakes. It's kind of comforting to the rest of us that even, the geniuses, they make mistakes. The second point was mistakes and blunders are really part and parcel of the scientific process. There are lots of false starts, blind alleys, and so on. And without those, we would just be wandering for way too long into wrong directions. And the third point that I wanted to make was that, sometimes to get to breakthroughs, you have to, we like to say, think outside the box. And guess what? When you think outside the box, you sometimes make mistakes. And there is nothing wrong with that, because this is what occasionally leads to the huge discoveries. There is a lot to say for incremental science, but sometimes you really must take that larger leap and which leads to breakthrough. And I want to just emphasize that I'm not advocating making sloppy mistakes or mistakes because of haste. I'm talking about thoughtful risk-taking, which sometimes could lead to a mistake, but sometimes can lead to something really big.
Well, why did you choose these specific blunders, and I'm using that in air quotes, to write about?
I spent a lot of time thinking about which scientists to use. And at the end, there were a number of guiding lines. One was, as I said, I want them to be very, very great scientists. Not, scientists that nobody heard of. Second, I didn't want to go too far back in history, because if you go too far back, if I go all the way back to Aristotle, let's say, who was definitely a genius, essentially everything he said in physics was wrong.
Right.
So that becomes, it's no longer interesting, anymore, which doesn't make him lesser of a genius than he actually was. But, it's just you went too far back. So I decided to go only to the middle of the 19th century. And finally, there is a certain connection that connects all these 5 people that I've chosen. And that's the concept of evolution. And by that, I mean evolution of life on Earth, evolution of the Earth itself, evolution of stars, and evolution of the universe as a whole. So this connects all these 5 individuals that I've chosen.
Well, the other thing that connects them is one of the ideas that you keep returning to in the book, the idea that scientists are human and that they're subject to the same human cognitive biases that the rest of us are.
Of course, yes. And they also react to them in the same way that the rest of us are, namely each one in a somewhat different way, but also somewhat similar way.
But these guys are often more right even in their mistakes than the rest of us, hence the brilliant part of their blunders.
That's right. So the brilliant blunders, mistakes that they were concerning big ideas. And yes, those sometimes lead to blunders, but, you know, those people, the people I discussed also, you know, led to enormous advances.
Now, you wrote about a number of scientists in your book, but I wanted to talk about Kelvin, because I don't think we've ever covered him on the show before. I could be wrong, but I don't think we have. So we might as well start with his mistakes. So who was Lord Kelvin?
So Lord Kelvin was probably the most prominent physicist of his time, which is kind of the end of the 19th century. Today, we remember him mostly because there is a temperature scale named after him. But he really did many, many things. And he was also one of these brilliant individuals who could very comfortably move from pure science to applied science, to engineering. You know, he was involved with the telegraphic cable undersea. He invented a galvanometer that was measuring electrical currents. He did a whole host of things that, you know, seemed completely unrelated, and yet he was able to do all of that. In the particular mistake that I'm discussing, or the blunder, is his attempt to calculate the age of the Earth.
Now, wasn't that a little outside of the area of his expertise?
Like I said, he was a person who was, at some level, an expert in everything. I mean, he, at some point, declared that he was a geologist as well. And the truth is, you see, that he did something which is quite phenomenal. He actually attempted to use the laws of physics to determine the age of the Earth, which before him was just a matter of, you know, speculation and wild guesses and things like this. He actually tried to do an actual calculation. You know, imagine you take a turkey, okay, at Thanksgiving. You take a turkey and just straight from the oven, you put it into the freezer. Then what's going to happen is, first, the very surface area is going to start cooling, and then, you know, slowly the temperature will start going down, going inwards into the turkey. So, in principle, by measuring the depth of the layer, which has become cold, you could tell for how long that turkey has been in the freezer. So, that's what Kelvin tried to do. Basically, the assumption was that the Earth formed very hot and molten, and that it is cooling ever since. Therefore, by determining how the temperature in the Earth changes with depth, he could determine, you know, how old the Earth is.
And how close was he?
He was very far, unfortunately. Yeah. He came up with a number that was about 100 million years, and the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. So he was, you know, too short by a factor of about 50. That doesn't sound like a good calculation, but it was a calculation, nevertheless, which was really based on laws of thermodynamics. So it was an impressive calculation in many ways. It's just that he unfortunately neglected some things that he didn't know that he should have not neglected.
And you say in your book that it wasn't really that his calculations were wrong, it was his assumptions.
That's right. So there are a number of assumptions that were wrong. The main thing that really introduced the big error in his calculation was the fact that he thought that heat is transported from the Earth's center to the outermost layer just by conduction, just, you know, the same way that a metal, you know, you put a metal in the fire, you hold the other edge of it, and, you know, conduction through the metal is how heat is transported. But in fact, what happens is that the interior of the Earth is somewhat fluid, even though it's not quite fluid like water, but, you know, it's somewhat fluid. And that means that the transport of heat inside the Earth happens by convection, you know, in the same way as you heat oil on in a pot, and, you know, it's the bottom layer gets hot, and then that liquid becomes less dense, so it starts moving upward, and the cold liquid comes down, and so on. So you create these currents, and he neglected that, and that really introduced the majority of the error in his calculation. A second thing he didn't know about was that the Earth is not just cooling down. Actually, there is a source of energy within the Earth, which is radioactive materials that are decaying and releasing heat. Of course, radioactivity was only discovered at the beginning of the 20th century, or understood that, you know, it releases heat and so on. And so, of course, he couldn't have included that. Usually that is cited as the main reason for his error, but in fact, that's not true. It's true that he neglected it, but the main error is introduced by this neglect of convection.
But you've titled the book Brilliant Blunders. So how is completely miscalculating the age of the Earth brilliant?
So first of all, it's brilliant because somebody can actually calculate the age of the Earth. Think about this. Suppose somebody comes to you and said, how would you calculate the age of the Earth? You know, I would have had no idea how to even begin. Well, today we know that there are these radiometric dating with radioactive material. But at this time, how do you even do this? So people before him, you know, they were using just numbers from the Bible, you know, things like that and so on. They just had no idea how to do this. And he came up with this idea that, you know, if the Earth started molten and it's cooling off, then he actually can use laws of physics to calculate the age. This was amazing. So it's brilliant in that way. A second way in which is brilliant is, you know, I'm looking at mistakes which eventually led to breakthroughs. And this business, this mistake of his neglect that the interior of the Earth is partly fluid, is actually what at the end, you know, once realized, led to our understanding of continental drift, of plate tectonics, which is a huge thing. So, like I say, his mistake is brilliant both in terms of the actual making a calculation like this, and that what his error was eventually also led to some incredible understanding. And actually, had that been understood earlier, we would have known about continental drift earlier.
Well, it's also the fact that his creation of this theory was sort of the starting point for a dialogue between the fields.
He actually made geologists realize that it's part of their job to actually try to calculate the age of the Earth, you know, which they didn't before, and they started this dialogue between geologists and physicists.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking with astrophysicist Mario Livio about his book, Brilliant Blunders. Okay, let's move on to Einstein. Now, his blunder was related to the cosmological constant. And so for non-physics folks, what is that?
When Einstein tried to apply his theory of general relativity to the universe as a whole, he realized that there was a problem. Because, you see, gravity was an attractive force. So everything in the universe attracts everything else. But Einstein thought at the time, in 1917, that everything in the universe is static, you know, the stars don't move, you know, and so on. Now, if everything attracts everything else, all of this should collapse. It shouldn't stay static. So what he did was he introduced into his equations another term, which was this cosmological constant. It introduced a repulsive force that precisely balanced gravity's attractive force at every point, because he wanted to make it static, you know, like sort of balancing a pencil on its tip. So he was happy with that for a while, even though it really was a bad solution. But then in 1929, Edwin Hubble discovered that our universe is expanding. Einstein said, well, wait now a minute. If the universe is actually expanding, I don't need to balance everything at every point, because all that gravity is going to do now is just slow down that expansion. You know, just like I kick a ball upwards and, you know, the gravity of the Earth slows it down. Eventually, in that case, you know, makes it return back. So he took that term out of his equation. He regretted having put it in the first place because, you know, he thought, well, he might have predicted that the universe is actually expanding. And that was kind of nice. Except that in 1998, two groups of astronomers discovered that the expansion of our universe is actually accelerating. Not only it's not slowing down, it's speeding up. And what appears to be driving this acceleration is exactly that cosmological constant that Einstein took out of his equations. So his real blunder was not to put that term in. It was actually to take it out of his equation.
So he was right even when he wasn't right.
That's right. He was right. Some people are just so smart that even when they think they made a huge mistake, that turns out to be an insight.
Now, sort of an aside, but not really. The idea that this was Einstein's biggest blunder, you did a bit of research into whether he actually called this his biggest blunder or not.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, this has become one of Einstein's most cited quotes, you know, that he called the cosmological constant the biggest blunder he made in his life. So I became somewhat obsessed with, had he actually used those words, you know, the biggest blunder he made in his life? And as far as I can tell, and I've done a lot of research on this, I've, you know, looked at all the papers, all the books, you know, all these things and so on. As far as I can tell, he never actually used that term. That term was invented by another brilliant physicist, George Gamow, who was known to kind of embellish his stories, and I believe he just added that.
Well, I'd like to point out that I checked the Wikipedia page, and it seems like it's still attributed to Einstein. So if anybody that is listening to this show edits Wikipedia, you might have something to do. But this is the thing about many of the blunders that you talk about in the book. They all build on a body of knowledge, and sometimes even like with the constant, they turn out to years later have been correct.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the other ones in the book, at least, are not of quite that type, you know, that they kind of, you know, changed like a chameleon, like, you know, from being considered a mistake to not a mistake and then an insight, you know, and so on. But it is certainly true that that they lead to other things. I, for example, just to mention, I discuss Linus Pauling's wrong model for DNA. Now, yes, his was wrong and Watson and Crick's was right, but Watson and Crick actually were using precisely Pauling's methods, actually, when they discovered the correct model.
So then what do you want people to take from this book?
First of all, I want them to realize that progress in science is really not this, you know, direct march along a straight line to the truth, as sometimes they teach us in schools or in presentations. I mean, progress in science, and in fact, in any creative enterprise, you know, is sort of this zigzag path, which, you know, many times you need to go back to where you started and so on. The second thing to realize is that mistakes, you know, are not the province of inexperienced or people who don't know better and so on. Even the greatest scientists make serious mistakes. But most importantly, I really want people to stop, you know, thinking that mistakes are something really bad. I mean, we are kind of taught from school, you know, and so on, that you shouldn't make mistakes and so on. And I really want to change that culture, because that then permeates to funding agencies and to so, you know, and so on. You're not allowed to make mistakes. But this is where I distinguish between, you know, those mistakes that are done because of carelessness and this thing which I call brilliant blunders. These mistakes that happen because people think outside the mainstream, because people take risks which they thought about very, very seriously, but, you know, where you cannot know in advance everything that's known. Because those are the ones that, you know, really can take you up sometimes a huge step instead of, you know, advancing incrementally.
So you want people to understand that our mistakes even have value, is what you're saying.
First of all our mistakes have value, but in particular, I want the system to allow for, you know, people who think unconventionally, even if sometimes that leads to mistakes.
Mario, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we've linked to Dr. Mario Livio and his book, Brilliant Blunders, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back with the author of Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age, right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by W. Bernard Carlson, Chair and Professor in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia, where he holds a joint appointment with the History Department. Bernie is an expert on the role of innovation in American history, and his research focuses on how inventors, engineers, and managers use technology to create new systems and enterprises between the very specific dates of 1875 and 1925. He's here to talk about his newest book, Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. Welcome, Bernie.
I'm very glad to be with you today.
Now, this was definitely a thoroughly researched Tesla biography. It spans from his childhood to his death, and you do get very in-depth around the science of his inventions. But you say that when writing this book, you had to navigate between unfair criticism and excessive enthusiasm. So why is that?
Well, Desiree, most of the recent biographies that have appeared for Nikola Tesla have been celebratory biographies that are absolutely fascinated with Tesla as a genius, as someone that invented, indeed, all of the technologies that we use every day, and he's been likened to Leonardo da Vinci. And so that's, on one hand, the excitement that is around Tesla. At the end of his life, or particularly right around the turn of the 20th century, he came in for a lot of criticism because he was regarded by his contemporaries as being too much of a poet and a visionary, as being a sort of impractical individual. And there are still to this day people that pick up on that, whether they think that Thomas Edison is more famous or that Marconi is more important in the development of radio. So I had to navigate a path between these contemporary biographies that are very excited about Tesla and some of the older literature that sort of says, well, Edison was a hero, Marconi was a great guy, so Tesla must have been a fluke.
It does seem that his work has often been somewhat overshadowed, at least by his personality. So maybe give us a sort of an overview of him as a person and what might have influenced his, let's call it eccentricity.
Tesla, first and foremost, is an individual who doesn't quite fit into any of the nice pigeonhole categories that we have for inventors. I mean, most of the inventors of the late 19th century were from Northern Europe. They were Protestant stock. They could easily be billed as being, in America at least, Yankees. And in contrast, Tesla comes from Southeastern Europe. He is not Protestant. His father is a priest in the Serbian Orthodox Church. And he is an immigrant. And so he's not that long line of Yankee stock. So right off the bat, he comes from an interesting and unusual background. And what I argue in the book is that his story is really about going back and forth between two themes. One is ideal, the other is illusion. And ideal is the notion that when Tesla invents, he invents in terms of whole systems that he can imagine in his head, and he wants to come up with the perfect way to develop that particular system. He's not interested in any shortcuts, any minor adjustments. He thinks those are just terrible. He wants it to be the absolute perfect way, and that has a lot to do with the religious background that he grew up in. At the same time, he felt that people didn't always necessarily understand the ideal, and to get their attention, to engage them, to have them be excited about his inventions, Tesla realized that what he needed to do was do dramatic demonstrations, fabulous lectures. He loved doing interviews for newspapers, and he wanted to create, if you will, all of the images and metaphors and stories that got people energized about new breakthrough technologies. And that's what I call illusions. He had to give you approximations of the possibilities of his new inventions. And so his life is an interesting tension between being this idealist and at the same time being this showman, being really one of the first sort of celebrity technologists that we have.
You did mention in the book that there are different styles of inventors.
Yes, and one of the particular facets of an inventor's style is their business strategy. That is to say, what their plan is for making money. An inventor like Thomas Edison frequently made money because he not only came up with a new invention, but once having patented the device, he went on ahead and put it into manufacture. That is to say, he'd set up a whole company, and in the case of electric lighting, he developed separate companies to make the incandescent bulbs, to build the electric generators, even a company that was going to be the construction division and actually go out and install power plants. And so inventors like Edison, their business strategy, part of their style is they're going to be manufacturers, they're going to be involved in business. That has the result that lots of inventors become famous because companies get named after them. And not surprisingly, there were a whole string of companies in Edison's time that were named after Edison and were in the business of producing his inventions. And indeed, there are still power companies to this day, such as in New York City, Consolidated Edison, which is carries on the Edison name. In contrast, another strategy, the strategy that Tesla decided to pursue, was a strategy that I call basically to patent, promote, and sell. Tesla would invent something. He would then work with his patent lawyers and get very strong patents for the invention, what we today would call intellectual property. And then he would begin to do a series of demonstrations, newspaper interviews, any number of activities that would get people all excited about this new invention and push it forward so that people would get very excited and he could sell the technology, the invention, to the highest bidder. And then he would take the money that he made from selling the intellectual property and go and start on a whole other project. The downside of that is that it means that Tesla never developed a big company as Edison did or Alexander Graham Bell did that, you know, carried on his name. And so after a certain point, Tesla's name sort of disappeared, if you will, from the business or industrial record. At the same time, while you might sort of say, well, it seems like a kind of a silly strategy, the patent, promote, and sell strategy is indeed the strategy that is used by most entrepreneurs today in Silicon Valley.
Can you give us an example of how that patent, promote, sell worked for him?
Probably one of the best examples is the development of his most famous and important invention, the alternating current motor. Before Tesla came along, there was only electric light and only electric lighting companies. And after Tesla and the invention of the alternating current motor, we were able to say that there was electric light and power, because the motor is the device that allows us to convert electricity into all types of mechanical motion. Now, in the 1880s, no one was quite sure that you were going to actually be able to develop a good alternating current motor, but Tesla proved them wrong and developed a motor over a number of years in the 1880s, but had his big success came to him in 1887. And he was able to develop the motor and basically promote it. But even from the beginning, while he was able to come up with a motor that reflected his perfect way of doing things, at least in Tesla's mind, which was to use a rotating magnetic field, the first motor that Tesla got to work in the laboratory in his workshop was essentially a great big coil of wire, looked like a donut. And in that donut, when the electric current was generating a rotating magnetic field, Tesla dropped in a tin can, a shoe polish tin, that was on a little pivot on a thumbtack. And of course, because of the rotating magnetic field, the tin can spun around. Tesla showed that to his backers, and his backers looked at it and they just said, "You brought us over here, you spent all this time, months and months and months, and our money, and you got a tin can spinning. What's the deal?" And what Tesla realized is in that experience in 1887 was he had to get the illusion right. He had to get a way of capturing people's imaginations. And so he went away and he thought about it. And this is in the period where people were very excited and they were starting to think about the 500th anniversary of the discovery of the Americas by Christopher Columbus, which was going to come in 1893. So, you know, they're starting to think about it. It's a few years before that, 1887. And so Tesla goes in one day and he says to his backers, he says, "So you know the story about Columbus and the egg?" And they go, "Oh yeah, we know the story about..." The backers said, "Oh yeah, we know the story about Columbus and the egg. Columbus is trying to convince Queen Isabella of Spain to invest in his ships and allow him to go and explore and sail across the Atlantic. And all of the scholars in her court are saying, 'Oh, no, 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 the world is flat, and there's this problem, and there's that problem,' and so on and so forth." And finally, Columbus has just had it with all of the academics in the court, and he finally says, "Can you make an egg stand on end?" And of course they say, "Oh, tut, 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 we can't possibly do that," and so on and so forth again. And so Columbus calls for an egg, takes the egg, whacks off the bottom of it with a spoon, makes the egg stand up. Queen Isabella looks at him and says, "You're my kind of guy." Gives him the money by, as legend has it, pawning her jewels. She didn't actually pawn her jewels, but suffice to say that she then put the money into Columbus's expedition. So Tesla tells the backers this whole story, and they say, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. We know the story. That's fine." And Tesla says, "Well, what if I can not only make the egg stand on end, but I can make it spin? And they said, you make the egg spin, we'll put some more money into your project. So Tesla goes off, buys himself a great big copper egg, goes back to the laboratory, hides the big donut coil of wire underneath the table. He doesn't want any distractions, puts a nice green felt tablecloth over the table, puts the egg in the middle of the table, invites the backers in, and says, you ready? And they say, yeah, sure. Turns on the electricity, and the egg starts spinning slowly on the green tablecloth, and eventually comes up and is spinning so fast that it's standing upright. It's rotating around its vertical axis. And they finally realize that he's on to something, that he actually, his backers realize that Tesla has come up with the next big thing in electricity, which is going to be the alternating current motor. So that's one of my favorite examples of how Tesla promoted his inventions and got people excited about them.
Well, and he was so heavily reliant on the illusion, as you say, on those demonstrations. But that kind of pandering was crucial for the time, was it not?
It was absolutely crucial. I mean, this is a period in, we're talking the 1880s, the 1890s, and the way that people were starting to think about technology, get excited about it, was via popular magazines and newspapers. This is the period where the tabloids that we know and love today were coming into being, and Tesla really was probably one of the first to understand the power of the popular press and to basically feed it the kind of stories and images that it needed in order to get ahead.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm here with W. Bernard Carlson, author of Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. So did that capacity for showmanship come naturally to Tesla?
That's an interesting question, Desiree. And I think on one level, he was at times a bit of a shy individual and not necessarily sure that he actually kind of wanted to go out and engage the world. He knew that to be a good inventor, he really needed to have a lot of quiet time in order to think about and visualize the things that he was doing in his mind. And so part of him, I think, was a bit loath to get too involved in the public eye. On the other hand, there was another side of him that was clearly gregarious and outgoing and absolutely loved being in the limelight, being the star of the show, and attracting all sorts of attention.
What did the public think of him?
The public absolutely loved him, and indeed, he arrived in the United States in 1884 in New York City as a penniless immigrant, and by 1894, he was absolutely the toast of the town and was regarded as likely to be as famous or as successful an electrical inventor as Edison. And regrettably, by 1904, 20 years after he had arrived in America, he probably had bottomed out and had not succeeded with his second big invention, which was to develop electromagnetic waves, what we would call radio waves, into a new form of technology. But in those years, he was of the 1890s, when he was at his zenith, at his height, he was as big a star as you could probably find.
He didn't just affect the way that the public saw engineering. He actually affected how engineers thought about motors as well.
Oh, yes. He clearly laid out the great possibilities for electricity and indeed set the pathways for the way that we use electric power even to this day. And he was willing to, you know, show people and engineers new ways of doing things. With the electric motor, he was absolutely convinced that what you needed in order to successfully transmit power or electricity that was going to be used for mechanical power, that you're going to need to send power at two or three phases. In other words, two or three waves of alternating current are embedded in your 60-cycle alternating current that goes through most houses in Canada and the United States. And he's the individual that basically, you know, showed people that that was the practical way to transmit power, that you could transmit more power over long distances if it was two or three phase, or as what Tesla would call polyphase. So he not only changes the public's imagination and perception of electricity, but he certainly also does indeed change the way that engineering gets done, both in his time and even today.
Well, what did they think of him, the other engineers?
Well, the other engineers were initially fairly comfortable with Tesla, and he was embraced as a member of the Electrical Engineering Society, what was then called the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, what's today the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. But as time went on, in some ways, the world changes around Tesla and his contemporaries. In the 1880s, where you could basically sort of point to your inventions, various other famous scientists or engineers would sort of stand up and say, you're an accomplished creative individual. By the early 1900s, the world of professional engineering and science has changed, and you need to, by then, have the attributes of expertise that we think of today. You need, if you're going to be someone that's distinguished in engineering or in the physical sciences, you have to have an advanced degree. And Tesla's time, the advanced degree was often from a PhD from a German university. You had to have publications. You had to have either a senior position in a university or in a large company. And Tesla, as we get into the early 1900s, has none of the attributes of a professional authority that everyone else is sort of assuming that you ought to have. And as a result, he's looked at with more and more suspicion. And indeed, he's made a series of promises because he loves to talk to the newspapers, he loves to talk things up, that he's not able to deliver on.
Before we move on to that, there was one other obstacle that he had to face, and there were rumors that he was gay, correct?
There were rumors that he was gay, and I should emphasize, Desiree, that that is about as far as I was able to go. In other words, I, in the book, report on the evidence and the information that I have. It's clear that he never married, that he had a series of relationships with men that he was clearly quite close to and had emotional, at least, you know, deep emotional ties to, that he seems to have loved these men. Now, whether, you know, his relationship with them, you know, had a physical component, we'll probably never know. The other important thing is to keep in mind is that, again, in the 1880s and early 1890s, notions of homosexuality were very different than they were, and then they came to be after 1900, and in particular after World War I, where by the 1920s, homosexuality was seen less as sort of a set of social traits and social behaviors, and more as something that was biological. You either were born gay or you weren't born gay. And so the whole situation that Tesla is operating in is far more fluid in the 1890s. But it's fairly clear that some of his behavior and some of his interest in men and particularly in younger men probably interfered with his ability to get on and interact with his fellow engineers in the Electrical Engineering Society. And I suspect that that's one of the reasons why he gets to be at least vice president in the organization, but never president. And in fact, it takes the AIEEE until 1916 to basically make him a fellow of the society and to make an award to him, which is ironically the highest award of the society is the Edison Medal. And so you can just imagine how Tesla felt about winning the Edison Medal.
So what would you say was the peak of his career?
Probably, well, I'd say two things. I mean, sort of in terms of public visibility, the peak of his career really comes in 1893 and 1894, where he is at the height of his showmanship abilities. He's able to hold audiences of upwards of 20,000 people. His public image is at its height in 1893 or 1894. From a technical standpoint, sheer creativity standpoint, I think my all-time favorite invention of Tesla's comes in 1898 when he develops a radio-controlled boat, which is able to basically sail around in a pond or a pool, and he's able to send signals to it so that it will turn, the lights will flash, it will back up, it'll go forward. It really is an incredible tour de force as to how he works out how to make that actually work, and that he demonstrates it.
This is Science for the People, and we'll be back to talk about where it all went wrong for Tesla after this.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're exploring genetics, neuroscience, and psychology to find out what makes every person and personality unique. We'll talk to science writer Jennifer Ouellette about her newest book, Me, Myself, and Why, Searching for the Science of Self. And science writer Ed Yong takes a critical look at the hype surrounding the hormone oxytocin. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my guest today is W. Bernard Carlson, chair and professor in the Department of Engineering and Society at the University of Virginia, and he's the author of Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age. Okay, so we have this famous, slightly odd, absolutely brilliant figure who's at the top of his game. So, of course, there is almost nowhere to go but down. So what happened?
If we think about, as I often thought about Tesla's life as being sort of a three-act play, and there's the first act that he's sort of on his way up, the second act where he's enjoying the limelight, he's at his best, and then there's a third act where he sort of slides into oblivion. The seeds of disaster or the seeds of what's going to happen in the third act are visible and planted in the second act. In 1889, Tesla becomes tired of dealing with Westinghouse and tired of problems with the alternating current motor. It's becoming less invention and more sort of straight-up routine engineering. And he leaves the Westinghouse company in Pittsburgh, and he takes a trip to the World's Fair in Paris in 1889. And there he hears about that Heinrich Hertz has detected radio waves for the first time, and Tesla's absolutely fascinated by that, and he repeats Hertz's experiments when he returns to his laboratory in New York City in late 1889, early 1890, and he begins to think about the possibility of developing some combination of some system that has a transmitter and a receiver, and that you will send radio waves from the transmitter to the receiver. Now, we know that one version of the story is the story of Marconi, which is that once you start messing around with radio waves, that the thing to do with it is to create a communication system, and in particular a broadcasting system where you have a radio station and, you know, and news and shows are put together, and then they're broadcast out and picked up by radio receivers in people's homes, cars, what have you. Well, Tesla really wasn't interested in this whole communications idea. He thought that the future of radio waves was in developing power transmission. Because remember, what the electric motor was all about using electricity to be able to power all sorts of different machines. So Tesla's first and foremost a power engineer. So he begins to experiment. He develops the Tesla coil, which allows him to generate high-frequency radio waves and high voltages, and he begins to experiment with having wireless lighting systems. That is to say, imagine that instead of having wires running all around your living room, Desiree, going to each and every, you know, lamp and other device, that all of the devices were wireless, that all you would have to do is kind of orient the lamp in the right direction of the electromagnetic field that's set up in your living room, and the lights would come on, and your cell phone would charge up, and the radio and the television would work.
Sounds
and
brilliant.
That was Tesla's original idea. And he basically puts that idea forward, and I think he really honestly thinks circa 1893, 1894, 1895, that the investors are going to just show up and throw money at him. And as it turns out, they don't. And part of the problem there is the mid-1890s, the entire world, but particularly the American economy, are suffering from a terrible depression of an economic recession, and nobody's really investing in a new technology like that. The other, I think, problem where Tesla begins to get himself into trouble is every time the business guys come to see it or there's another story in the paper, it's evolved one more time, and it's gotten more complicated, and it's got additional bells and whistles to it, and it rather than converging on a very specific, clear-cut market, which the business people can envision and invest in and kind of build a company around, Tesla's changed his mind one more time, and so it's a moving target for them. But another thing that bothers living daylights out of Tesla is he goes back to the original physics. Now, radio waves are a form of radiation. That is to say that they are traveling through space and they are flowing in all directions. And indeed, if you remember some of those things at like the beginning of movies from RKO, one of the old Hollywood movies, there is a radio antenna on the top and you see these circles, concentric circles radiating out from the radio tower. That image is exactly how radio waves travel, and they keep traveling in all directions, you know, for all time, on into space. Well, that bothered the heck out of Tesla, because he said, if you're making radio waves and you're sending them up the antenna, then you're like only a small percentage, maybe even a fraction of a percentage, are ever going to get to somebody's receiver. He said, this is a bad idea. So he decided that instead of sending the radio waves through the atmosphere, which is what we do today, that he was going to instead create oscillating electric currents, which he was going to send through the Earth. And if he could do that, he decided he could send power wirelessly everywhere. And so why mess around with just wireless lights in your living room when he could basically pull an end run around all of the electrical utilities that have been built up and eliminate all of those ugly wires and transmission towers that you had and have the electricity just simply come to your home or your business basically be pumped up through a pipe that was pounded into the ground or into your foundation.
Well, it sounds glorious, but it didn't work, correct?
It didn't work. Yeah. Right. Yeah. As we often say, you know, it was a great ideal, but the devil is in the details. And indeed, Tesla really believed that it was going to work. And the hang-up, or the problem as I understand it, is the following. Is as Tesla sort of said, the Earth is like a water balloon. So imagine a balloon filled with water, and you have a little pump on one side of the balloon. Okay, so if the water inside the balloon is as physicists would say, it's an inelastic fluid. Well, if you start pumping at just the right rhythm on the one side of the balloon, and you got little valves all around the other side of the balloon, and you pump at just the right rhythm, which is the resonant frequency of the balloon, you know, with every stroke eventually of the little pump, water will squirt out the other side of the balloon. Okay, because the fluid is inelastic inside the balloon, okay? And so the energy just kind of transmits easily through that fluid. Now, the problem is that's how Tesla thought the Earth was supposed to work from an electromagnetic standpoint, okay? And that, so, you know, you could basically pump energy into the Earth, say, wherever you wanted to build a great big power plant, say at Niagara Falls, and the energy would come popping out in the middle of Alberta or wherever, or Newfoundland, wherever you wanted it. And indeed, the Canadian government, according to at least one book, looked pretty carefully at this in the early 1870s, I think probably mostly to get power to either Newfoundland or Labrador. The difficulty is the Earth is not filled with an inelastic fluid from an electromagnetic standpoint.
Right.
It's filled with a fluid that is elastic. So think of another little thought experiment, which is you take a stone and you throw it in to the ocean. You know, here we'll use Vancouver. You know, you're on the Pacific coast of Canada, and do the waves from your little stone make it all the way across to Siberia or Japan? Well, no, because eventually the waves peter out. The mass of the ocean, the mass of the water, basically eventually absorbs all the energy, so the little waves disappear. Because the ocean is an elastic medium, and the Earth is filled, for all intents and purposes, with an elastic medium, you know, so Tesla's idea was never, ever actually going to work. Now, there are people who still ponder this and work very hard on it, but they haven't been able to make it work more than over some fairly short distances.
And right around there is when he had a breakdown. Correct.
That's right. Yeah. So Tesla, remember, as we talked about it a few minutes ago, was an idealist inventor. And he was convinced that he could perceive the ideal way of doing things. And indeed, he conducted experiments that convinced him that he was with his experiments about transmitting energy through the Earth, that the Earth should be working the way that it was supposed to be working. And he was eventually developed a high degree of hubris, and he said, I'm never wrong. And so he gets in a very difficult position circa 1904, 1905, where on one hand, his system is not working. He's not figuring out how to pump electrical energy into the Earth. The Earth is not functioning the way that he thinks it should work. And so he has a choice. Either the Earth is wrong or he's wrong. Well, in the middle of that, those two lousy choices, he cracks up.
Oh.
Which is just, you know, is a terrible, tragic story, which is, you know, because we really want to believe in him as this visionary who's able to by the power of his mind, impose order on our world. And indeed, one of the reasons why we still love Tesla or love any number of inventors and scientists is because they do demonstrate this ability of the creative, smart, rational individual to bring some kind of order out of chaos. I mean, the Wright brothers looked around and they saw birds were flying, but they didn't understand how. And the Wright brothers extract just the right set of ideas from looking at birds and are able to basically create an airplane. In other words, through the power of their minds, they are able to order flight.
Before I feel too bad for Tesla, so after that point, after his breakdown, he basically becomes reclusive, but he doesn't exactly stop inventing, right?
No, he continues to invent, and in the 1905 to 1920s, he works very hard on a new form of a steam turbine. Tesla develops a very distinct disk turbine, which he works on very hard, and he's on the right track, beginning in the late 1890s, but all the way through into the 20th century, people realize that the future of basically electric generation and lots of other applications of steam are not going to use the good old-fashioned reciprocating steam engine with the big pistons and cylinders. Okay, that those are inefficient and they're big and they're clumsy and they're going to go away. And Tesla clearly understands that the world needs for whether we're talking electric generation or we're talking airplanes, we're talking automobiles, that you're going to need a small, powerful engine. And so he's right to work on it. He just, again, he can't quite get the engine to ever work as well as he would like.
At this point, I should probably mention the particle beam weapon.
Oh, the particle beam weapon. Everybody wants to know about the particle beam weapon, Desiree. I was very graciously supported in this project by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and they are interested in the public understanding of science and technology, and they 15 years ago when I started this project basically sort of said, we think Tesla's a really important individual, but there's no reliable biography. You seem to be a reliable guy. Would you go and write a reliable biography of him? So I said, sure. And about 3 years into the project, I had to call in and check in with my program officer, and I was basically ticking off that I had been to the archives in Yugoslavia, and I had done this, and I had figured out that, and, you know, kind of running down the list. And he said, stop right there. What about the particle beam weapon? I was like, oh, well, I haven't really figured that one out yet. So he said, well, get back to me when you do. So everybody's interested in the particle beam weapon, and even my program officer. So what happens is Tesla, for his 75th birthday in the 1930s, decides that he's going to have, in July, it's his birthday always, he always celebrated his birthday on the 10th and 11th of July. He was born on midnight between those 2 days, and he would have an interview, basically a press conference, and he would basically tell people about the newest things he's been working on and tell them stories about his past, and reporters would all come in, and that would be fine. So he gets to about the 78th birthday, so he's done it now for a couple of years, and he walks in and he sits down and he says, you know, these big worries about giant bombers coming across the ocean to bomb the United States, to bomb New York, don't worry about it. And the reporters all kind of, you know, put down their pens and they sit forward and they say, you know, okay, why? And he says, I got the particle beam weapon. I got it all worked out. So Tesla's idea was is you were basically going to take a great big Tesla coil and you were going to energize tiny particles of mercury, and they were going to be, sent out at such force from sort of a gun that they could be pointed at an airplane, and they would basically heat up the airplane and kill the pilot by making his blood boil. And, of course, the pilot dies, the plane crashes, and, you know, no more worried about the bomber attacking the United States. And he sort of said, you can imagine that my particle beam weapons can be used to create an entire Chinese wall of defense protecting, you know, all of North America.
He is a humble man.
You know, make no small plans. I mean, if you're going to, you're going to think big, think big. I mean, you know, the thing about the particle beam weapon is that, you know, the basic idea of sort of accelerating particles is fine. And in fact, the old-fashioned TV tube that we grew up with, in your color television or what have you, has an electron beam gun in the back of it. And essentially, the reason why you see the image is these electrons hit the back of the screen, and they basically illuminate a phosphorescent screen or material that's on the back of the inside of the TV screen. So we can do that. Now, notice that we were talking about for the TV tube that you've got electrons. The slight problem with Tesla's idea about a particle beam weapon was he wasn't talking about subatomic particles. He was talking about what physicists would call macroscopic particles.
Right.
He was talking about actual little teeny tiny balls of mercury, okay? It takes a lot of energy to accelerate an electron. It takes even more energy to accelerate even a little teeny tiny ball of mercury. Never mind the fact that how do you make sure that all the little teeny tiny balls of mercury all actually go exactly where you want? In other words, how do you keep the beam focused? So, it wasn't ever really going to work. But that didn't stop the fact that when Tesla dies in 1943, the U.S. government, particularly the FBI, sort of says, he said he had a particle beam. Let's make sure that we get the plans to the particle beam weapon, if there are any, and it doesn't fall into the hands of our enemies.
Well,
so all of his papers are seized in 1943.
But see, this people can say that it doesn't work as much as they want, but the people who live on the internet don't agree. Because there are entire conspiracy theories built around
this. Oh, yes,
this.
Yes, yeah. You know, one of my favorite professors basically would sort of point out, he would say, never assume a conspiracy when mere ineptitude will suffice. In other words, I'm sorry, but you know, there is kind of an Occam's razor, which is when you have a fairly simple explanation as to what happened, you should go with the simpler explanation and not the more elaborate explanation. So the bottom line is that for Tesla's device to work, you'd have to overcome these basic physics problems. I know that there are people out there on the internet that sort of say, well, the fact that his papers got seized and then they went to Yugoslavia and basically the Yugoslavs sided with the Soviets. And so, until the late 1990s, nobody ever got to see the papers. In fact, I had problems even seeing some of the papers. I suspect that, you know, if I walked in the first day in the archives and said, I don't want to see anything else except the particle beam papers, they probably would have just basically not. I'd be still sitting on the curb in front of the museum. That's because all of that happened doesn't mean that the physics doesn't have to be taken into account.
This, I can't help but think that Tesla wouldn't be wonderfully pleased that people are still talking about him.
Oh yeah. Oh, he would. He's in inventor heaven. I mean, he's basking in the fact that people are still, you know, debating and taken up by his illusions. Because again, one of the things is he wanted us to engage in how technology was going to change our futures. And if that meant doing a demonstration, telling you a story, pushing forward the boundaries of what the human mind could do, what we were going to be able to do with technology, he was all for it. And in a certain way, I was thinking about this just after I finished the book, but a few weeks ago, he's in some ways the ultimate Victorian, in the sense that he has this incredible optimism about human progress and about progress driven forward by the sort of the ability of the human mind to order the physical universe, and that you shouldn't worry about it. That somehow, if you throw the switch and you turn on the big machine, the world isn't going to blow up. We live on another, historically on the other side of a divide where we've seen how things can come perilously close to disaster. We've lived through the atomic bombs of World War II. We live still with the threat of nuclear annihilation. We're vitally aware of a series of environmental problems Tesla was one to push for conservation and other things. But he had a degree of technological optimism that we'll probably never quite see again or feel again.
Bernie, thanks very much for being here. That was wonderful.
Great. Well, I hope we put some new perspectives on it, and you know, you certainly drew me out in some new ways that I haven't had the chance to do before. So.
Perfect. I like to hear that. And we've linked to W. Bernard Carlson, author of Tesla, Inventor of the Electrical Age, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and to subscribe to the show in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.